I woke up one morning and I walked in the street and everybody was looking at me differently. And I was like, shit, did I like piss on myself or what is wrong? Is my face burnt and I don't know? But everybody was like, yo, we just saw your video, man. That stuff is dope. Keep better forever.
From 2728 Pictures, this is Just Dropping In, a show about the influencers and creators who reframe the lens on people, places, and ideas. On this episode, how Octopizzo emerged from the largest slum in Kenya to become one of the most recognized hip-hop artists in all of East Africa.
A-Town, P-I, double Z, Refugee Genius.
I don't need no intro, track drops and I flow, and I keep it going, representing on the 250. Cherry the bikini at home, the sour come through with a little bit of some afro, plus rap so older. Wait a minute.
When Octopizzo found out he was invited to the 60th Annual Grammy Awards at Madison Square Garden, he posted a black and white photo to Instagram. Like Clark Kent ripping his shirt to unveil Superman, Octopizzo standing in front of what appears to be Kibera, the slum that he grew up in, with a faux fur jacket pulled back to reveal the image pressed to his t-shirt. It's a picture of his parents, cropped from the shoulders up. His mom looks exactly as he described her, serious but beautiful and strong. An African gangster lady who didn't mess around when it came to planning and discipline, as if she knew her time might come early. And then there's his dad, smiling as if he just heard one of his favorite reggae tracks and is ready to slide his girl to the dance floor before they have to go back home to the kids. The only thing obstructing their faces are their wedding bands, which now are resting on chains that hang from the neck of the son they were no longer here to protect. His dad passed at 13, and his mom at 14. His caption reads, "Wish Mom and Pops were here so I could take him to the Grammys. First Kenyan artist, probably first East African, to be invited. Hashtag, I did it for you, Mama. They're never looking down on us again." As you'll hear, Octopizzo's hustle and motivation to be a man, that was mom's doing. The motivation to be something, to be a superstar, that came 6 years later when he signed a release form to get his newborn daughter out of the incubator because he couldn't afford to keep her there. It's a wild story, only surpassed by his rise to the top of the charts. A journey that is only explained if you understand his love and admiration for the sprawling Nairobi slum that he grew up in.
Growing up in Kibera is just like anywhere. It's like growing up in heaven. It's like you don't know anything when you come to this world. You don't know which is the good thing and the bad thing. Who is poor, who is sick. You see kids on TV, you just think, that's another world. So that's not ours. But this ours is pretty good too. I've been lucky to travel a lot. But there's nowhere that has a community love and ambience than Kibera, period. You know, the community sense is just out of this world.
And for your parents, would they just let you run free? And because I have to imagine it feels pretty community, village safe.
Yeah, my dad loved if I made friends. My dad was a big fan of Mike Tyson and Michael Jackson. So in weekends, we like go and watch boxing or listen to his record player in the house. My mom was a very serious, like true African gangster lady. You know, she didn't like jokes. She didn't, those things like sports was never her thing. She was about school. You either go to school or you don't do anything else. And being a firstborn of my family, I was raised very different. There was no boy or girl. So I did every job. I knew how to cook when I was like, I think 10 years old. I knew how to cook food for my sisters. I knew how to go to the garden. I knew how to make basket. I knew how to get water from the river, carrying it on my head. This is the stuff that were considered only for females. But once I was like in high school, like when I was like 13, 14, after homework, she opened for me a business. So out of her saloon, she had a salon. I would go there and sell like groundnuts and maize. She used to tell me, this is not how your life's gonna be. You have to do business, which is the opposite of my dad. My dad was like, why is my mom working? The lady should be at home. So, you know, there was all these different vibes all the time. And also my dad was very fashionable, so all like the fashion and like this like love for music I got from him. My mom was the opposite. It was like the African gangster nerd.
What does that even mean, African gangster mom?
Being from an African home where your dad should be like the superhero and then your mom comes and take that role. Because even punishment, if you make a mistake, he'll just say, do you want me to tell your mom? And once he tells you, yeah, like he'll tell you it in a very slow motion way, but it's like being hit by thunder before even it happens. Like, do you really want me to tell your mom what you did? Or do you want to correct it before she comes home? Like, that's a gangster African mom. Like, just name dropping her name makes things go perfectly before her appearing. You know, it's so nuts. But I felt like I only had time with her for 15 years. And I realized from then when she left until today, even things that I learned in school, like I loved literature as a student in high school because I never went to university. That's the only thing that I got from school. But everything I do today, I picked like probably 80% from my mom, 10% from my dad, and 10% from school. Wow. Like how that's how my mom was like I feel like I'm my mom in another world somehow. It's so crazy.
So are those some of the fondest, I mean, everything that you're able to do now, you can travel the world and go all these places. When you think back of being that 13 or 14 year old kid starting a business with mom, is those the mental images that kind of pop up first, or is it even before that when you were a younger kid?
I think it started popping out more like even after that she went is when I realized how like similar we were, or like everything she used to tell me, like it's like she kept saying, you have to be better than us. You have to go to school and get better education and, you know, take care of the family. This is how it works. There's no other way. Like she did stuff that I didn't know. She joined like a microfinance thing because After 6 months, some random person calls me, some random white dude, like, hey, your mom used to be in this microfinance thing and she saved some money, and this money, we want you to finish school. So we'll only be giving you this money when you're going to pay school fees and you bring us the receipt, nothing else. It was crazy. And they were so religious too. So they didn't believe in this like bank and stuff. But on the side, my mom was doing this thing, which I'm sure even my dad didn't know.
Wow.
Because I didn't know. And just thinking about it, how like she even saved for that without anybody knowing. And there's days that we didn't even eat, but she didn't even go and take that money so that we can eat. It's like some crazy sacrifice. Or even knowing that she was sick and she might die and she could go and take that money and go to the hospital and feel better. She didn't do that. It like really sometimes disturbed me on a negative way and also on a positive way. Something really crazy that I've never come to understand.
You know, it's funny that we opened speaking about me wondering what the difference is between a gangster African mom and maybe any other mom somewhere else. And that's gangster. Seriously.
Yeah, that's
like that. That's like that side hustle that you don't tell anybody about, and you find out about it from a random white dude that calls you and says, hey, this is how you're going to get your school done. That's wild.
Yeah. And that's how I finished my school. And nobody ever, like, I feel I'm always so proud as nobody. Because here, if somebody even help you a little bit with school fees, it's something they will mention for the rest of their life. Like, you will never be an artist if I didn't take you to school. So just knowing that this was done by my mom, like I'm who I am today, because my mom made like some crazy gangster sacrifices. Like there's nobody in the world that I think is more gangster than that. People think shooting people is gangster. Shooting people is the most weakest thing, because that means you're scared of that person. But sacrificing yourself for something that you don't even know what future holds, you don't know even if your son loves school or he doesn't, or he might die tomorrow, that shit is crazy.
Wow.
It's so crazy.
When you did, and you lost your mom when you were a second year of high school, and then your dad shortly after, right? I mean, that's a big life change.
I started with the dad. I lost my dad when I was 13, then my mom when I was 14. One in November 2002, the other one November 2003. It was nuts.
Were they sick?
It was nuts.
Did you have any warning that it was coming?
There was no warning. My dad got sick for a while. Like him, we went to visit him in hospital, And he used to tell us, like, I feel better. It's just this, because he was a spray painter. My dad was a spray painter. But they never, like, had protection, like masks when you're spray painting, like cars. Here, they just did it, like, hardcore way. But my mom, on the other side, just left on a Saturday when we were washing clothes, because every Saturday, I only went to school, like, half day sometimes and come back home, and that's a day for washing, like, the all-week clothes. So the clothes we wore from Monday to Friday is washed on Saturday. So we were just washing clothes out in the veranda. And then it was like, I don't feel well. I feel like I'm catching a cold. I'm just going to walk to the hospital. You finish this stuff, then I'll see you. I'll see you back later. Just make sure you finish this stuff. And she went walking. She took herself, like going to a shop to buy a credit or like sugar. And she never came back. She went there and she got admitted. I went the next day and she passed the next day around like 2 p.m. It was nuts.
What do you do the next day? That's not easy for a kid.
That was the most messed up part of my life. Like, it's still like, I still get like traumas from that until today.
When you come back home the next day, like, did you, I mean, I imagine it takes a little while to come to grips with what just happened, but did you, mm-hmm. how quickly did that sense of responsibility kick in?
Kick in the same day. The same day, like, you go home and now you realize people are just there now. Everybody's looking at you like, hey, did you know? Where can we find this? Where can we find this? Like, why are you asking me? You're like, why are you asking me? You know, I just came back from school. I don't know anything. But then you realize, like, your little sisters are crying. You're asking if they ate. You don't know what to do. You don't know anything. Everything is like your life just get deleted and somebody brought you back and tell you, okay, start afresh. But you don't know where to start. And I was doing my exams for finishing the year. That year, it was terrible. I failed really bad.
Did you hear your mom's voice kind of saying, you got to pick this back up again, like you can't mess this school thing up?
I think what, like, really kept me going is just knowing who she was and how she would like me to, like, deal with a situation like that. And also being that my dad passed first and I saw how she handled the situation. It was hard on her, very hard, but she never showed it to us. Like, I would hide sometimes. I would lie like I'm going to bed, but I'm not going to bed. And I would see her sitting in her bed and cry until, like, I fall asleep. And I wake up and I still find her in the same position. And that shit is so crazy.
It really is.
So I realized, like, whatever she was going through, nobody, not even Mia, could help, even if I knew. Like, we didn't know where to, I don't know how, what was happening.
That's a lot for a kid. That's really, really something. And then you're, not to mention your sisters.
Yeah, I had two sisters and a brother.
Check, check.
When Octo Pizzo finished high school, he wasn't even thinking about music. He just wanted to get a better job and get married. He missed having a family because when his mom died, he lost his siblings too. They had to go live with his grandmother in a village 8 hours outside of Nairobi. He needed a familial lifeline, and he found it when he started hanging out at the barbershop. That's where all the action was. There, at an event held once a month for emerging artists at the British Council.
It was like a 40-minute walk. I just walk, entry is free. I sat there and just see, you know, artists like entertaining, there was graffiti. So just being, I just went there to like have fun. I went there like as a fan, as somebody could go for a festival. I never went there to find out, oh, I'm a rapper and I want to perform here.
You spoke openly about this before. You had joined a gang at some point. Was that, did mm-hmm. those two chapters of your life overlap there?
No, that was like, even when, like, now I'm like trying to find a job during this 2 year where I'm in the garage is where, like, now I'm meeting new people in Kibera that I never knew, like the weed sellers who are really cool, and I'm meeting friends that we, you know, like I was with in high school, and then we meet again. It's like, hey, what's up with your life? What do you do these days? My best friend then was also doing business. He was selling shoes. But then during weekends, we all hung out like at barbershop. So at the barbershop, a lot of things happen. People buy weed there. People get their hair cut. People make their deals there. People meet their girlfriends there. Like, this was the place where you see everything. You know, you want to, like, get love, you go hang in a barbershop. Maybe a pretty chick will pass by and you say hi. You want to get lit and get high, there's somebody, a dealer will pass there. And that's when I realized, like, people always don't understand drug dealers or like we say, like, slum gangsters who you never know, you never see them, but you just hear about them. But they care so much about the young generation. Like, for them, when they send you to sell that thing, is then they're teaching you business. For them, they don't see the part of, hey, I'm sending you to sell drugs. No, for him, he's telling you, I'm teaching you business. This is how these streets work. You can go to the garage and do your job, it's fine. But if you don't get enough there, you have another option here. And you can always leave whenever. Like, they were too cool. Or when you don't have money for food, just come, we'll get you money for food. So it was like a gang, but it's like a brotherhood gang, you know, where everybody's also looking for one another. It was not
so
a
it doesn't
gang.
Have a definitive name. It was just like a group of people.
Yeah, a group of people and that did it together. And some once in a while, two of your people from the group, you'll hear like, oh, we just robbed this guy, man. We were so hungry, and he had a new phone. So even in the same gang, there's always like the robbers, and there's just the guys who just hang out and say, oh, you really robbed that guy? Why? And they're just like, they'll be like, ah, man, I just felt like robbing him. You know, it's like nothing. It's just a phone anyway.
Did you have that same temptation, or did you just kind of skate along and know that you could go to the garage and go to the British Council and kick it and then just hear their stories?
When you're in this group, it's kind of like you have to prove yourself. So it's like an initiation. So you always feel like you also have to do something that's really badass to get a respect from the gang. So at some point, yeah, I did it like, I think, three times. I broke in a shop where, like, they sell like this airtime. We broke in somebody's place where we told him like, hey, we just need like 300 shillings, which is like, it's like $3. We just needed $3 that day. And if you don't have $3, we will beat you. So you have to give us $3.
Did he give you the $3?
Like, sometimes they give you, sometimes they don't.
No, but your particular situation, like, did you actually get the $3?
No, there was no $3. I started realizing everybody in Kibera anyway doesn't have that money. So for us, even as young people who were in this group, we started realizing, like, why are we really, like, stressing our own guys? Because, yes, there's guys around here who have shops. So we started thinking, like, these guys who have shops and have money should always give these guys who don't have food when they don't have food. So we should not be robbing just random guys on the road who's, like, somebody's from work, from hustling, probably. That $3 is all he had. But there's this other guy who has a shop that is packed with food. Yet there's 10, 20, 50 to 100 families not eating tonight. They don't deserve it. And there's a way this start hitting you, and then you start remembering like where you're from and your family and when you slept hungry. And it hits you really hard that you feel like you're doing the right thing at this point. You go to a shop and tell them, we want this kind of money and we don't want stories.
Wow.
So it gets really deeper, like, as you hang out with these guys, and there's people think they're just random and smart people. They are not. They are very smart. They think very, like, colonial way. And to some extent, if you ask me, it's correct, and to some extent, it's bad. It's correct.
Well, there's a rationalization around, it seems, this idea of, okay, they have, we don't. Like, let's redistribute some of this back to ourselves.
Or Or why don't you, like, if you tell us, like, hey, I have this shop, but I will not give you money, but I can promise to support this family or support this kid to go to school. You know, like, it can be a community thing. We always, for me, that's where I learned how to be, how to, like, even start a community. Because through that gang is when, after that, and after, like, joining British Council for this this thing that they used to do every month, I started my own group with young people who used to hang in barbershops. We didn't even know our talents then. We're just like, we need somewhere where we can just sit and talk. You talk about your pain at home. You talk about your dad. You talk about something you don't like, something you really like. And we try to find each other then, because we never had father figures. The only father figures we had were these guys in the streets. And we started thinking, like, what if, like, there was, like, a community where, like, hey, we can say, hey, you guys who have shops, every night we can take care of your shops as security, then you pay us instead of going to rob them. Or every month you guys have to give, like, this family some food. And it's not like we are asking. That was the only difference. We were not asking. We were demanding. So you didn't have a choice. That's the gang part of it. Like, you didn't have a choice.
So the shop owner down the street that had a real business going, you demanded it. You said, hey, you're going to give some money to this family or group of families.
Yeah, these families are not eating. They don't have money. But the people who are making your shop go on, is this guy still? These guys in the slums are the reason you're still here, and that's the reason you have a business.
And you provide
security.
So those
security. Who have, yeah, and then we provide security. So okay. We did that for a long time until I think my music started catching up. We did that for a long time. I stayed in touch a lot, like, until I think 3 years ago with my guys. Three or four guys died. Two moved. Two went to Saudi Arabia. They're working there. One went to, like, Mombasa, started doing a job there. I became an artist. One has opened his own garage now, like, he's doing welding. And my best friend is still doing his shoe business. So as much as there was, like, wins and losses, you know, but it was a nice learning for me. When I hear, like, people talking about being gangsters and like selling drugs in their songs, I never understand it, that is something of pride. It's not a pride thing. It's a lesson that we learn, and is like a stage. We do stuff because that's the only thing that can be done then.
Did you ever feel like you needed to leave? I mean, like, your group, right? Like, there's so many, not necessarily, it doesn't happen as much in Kenya, but did you ever feel like, okay, we got to get out, like, not just get out of Kibera, but we got to get out of Nairobi. We got to get out of here. We got to go north.
For me, like, getting out was never an option, because I never knew anybody in my family or my friends that was successful or that didn't live in Kibera. So everybody I knew, 1 to 100, lived in Kibera. The only time I was like, okay, I'm going to stop, like, all this hanging out just to hang out, is when my daughter was born, because my daughter was born in 2009. For me, that was nuts. It was like an eye-opener. I didn't have a house. I was sleeping at my friend's by then. I had a lady who was pregnant and just gave birth. She's in hospital. They need 15,000 Kenyan shillings, which is, I think it's like $150. And I have like 200 shillings.
Did you think you needed to rob something to make the difference up? Or was your thought like, oh, I got to hustle?
The worst thing is that my daughter was born before her time. So she was in an incubator. So she was born with 7 months. And this was the time that I felt the craziest. I never felt like, oh, I should go and rob somebody and fill this up. I just felt like I need to know how I'm going to find this money legitimately, and my kid has to survive. Like, I never slept for like a month. I went to the garage, I washed everybody's overall. I sold like scrap metal, because I had to call my lady every time in the hospital to wake her up like 3 a.m. at night, because she had to go breastfeed the kid in the incubator, and the kid is like in a different floor. It's like on second floor, and the mothers are sleeping on the fifth floor. And if you don't wake them up, the kid might starve to death. it doesn't matter what I'll do, but she has to survive. Because every time I went there visiting, there were two kids in every incubator. The other kid was always dead. So every time I always think, okay, she's next, she's next. I go the next day, she's still there. I'm like, yes, thanks, thanks, Jesus. Like, this is the only time, like, I feel like even God existed. Like, thank Jesus, she's still alive. You go the next day, until the money that was piling, I couldn't pay. And I told the doctors, like, I want a discharge today because I can't pay this money as the way it's keeping to, like, every day it's piling. I will not be able to pay. So my best friend's girlfriend offered to pay that 15,000, all of it. And I was like, what? Like, yeah, I will pay. She was the only one working then. She paid everything, that 15,000. The doctor told me the kid cannot leave now because even 1 month has not finished and she's not very stable. She can't breastfeed alone yet. She doesn't have energy to suck the milk. And I was like, I don't care. This is my kid. I'm leaving with my kid right now. So they just gave me a letter to sign that if anything happened to the kid, it's not the hospital, that I'm the one who signed. And I said, fine. And I signed and took my kid, went and bought like 10 blankets to make sure she was warm. Did some little Google search on how to make the kid like warm and how to feed the kid. And I did it. And my daughter became my daughter. It was hard. It was not easy the way I'm putting it, but it was at least 5 months of something that really changed everything. Everything until today. Like my daughter was like the second coming of my mom. Like, this was like it for me to prove to her, like, look, I never took all the stuff you told me for granted. I'm gonna do this. The harder, the easier way, life or death, I'm going that way.
So that's where the queen bee comes in, huh?
That's when this lady now comes in. Now she's been the only motivation I have.
When his daughter was born, Octo Pizzo started doing some spoken word at the British Council events. There were hundreds of performers each month, and only a select few could get paid. Once he got going, he knew he had to ride his way out and find an audience. The only problem was, he was writing about Kibera, politics, and poverty. And the lyrics were just too hardcore for commercial radio. Where they could live, though, was on Facebook and YouTube. And that's when he really started making a push to make music. Shortly after, in 2012, he caught a break. The hottest DJ in the country showed up at the British Council, and Octo Pizzo was armed with new tracks and a new video.
He was like the hottest DJ in the country. He had the biggest show on TV in Kenya, period. Like, until today, it's like the MTV base of Kenya. So he went and listened to this CD and called me like after a week. Like, hey, can we meet? Because in all my CD, I used to write my name and my number on top of it, like with a marker pen. Like, if you like this CD, you can call me. And he called me and we had a sit down and told me, like, so what do you want? Because that time I was just freestyling. So I told him what I, for personally, what I want. I want to make money. I want to move out of the slums. I don't want my daughter to go through all this that I went through. So I don't care what should be done. I can rap. If you want me to even do an album today, I'll give you an album in the morning. If you want, with 20 songs. So you tell me, what do I need to appear on that TV show? Because I'm going to do it today. And it was just crazy that we clicked and he saw like the hunger I had. And he told me, okay, first we're going to take this video and play it. The first song was called Voices of Kibera. And he played it. It was like the beat of the week. So it was like the song of the week. So it was played every day at 1700 hours. So when I started seeing people paying attention, I went back to the studio and did another video. And then when this video came out, now I went commercial. It was called On Top, because it just blew out. It like went crazy. I woke up one morning and I walked in the street and everybody was looking at me differently. And I was like, shit, is there like a riot? Or did I like peace on myself? Or what is wrong? Is my face burnt and I don't know? But everybody was like, yo, we just saw your video, man. That stuff is dope. Keep better forever. It was, and then this is when like it started getting to me like, okay, we are on. And again, in 1 month, I went back to the studio, did another track, also went like double successful than the other one. That is now 2013, 2014. So in 2013, I had like the hottest song in the country. And I started getting calls from like Guinness, and then Safaricom, then Coca-Cola. And I was like, no way. I was like, how? Like, this is not real. And I moved, first thing is I moved out of the slums. I brought all my family, because for me, I was doing that because I wanted to see my siblings. Till then, I hadn't seen my siblings.
Wait, so hold on. So the first year that you start to break, like 2013, 2014, that really had been 7 years since you had seen your little sisters. Yeah. And your brother, right?
Yeah.
Whoa.
So in 2013, I brought my younger brother first. He was like then in primary school. My sister was about to finish primary school. After she did a class 8, I brought my sister too. My sister was now like a little bit elder, was like just who is the second born after me, was doing like also trying to do the same business my mom was doing of salon in Mombasa. And even at some point, she was the one who was sending us money when I was still like trying to figure out my music stuff. So she used to send us like 500. Like I was told like, hey, your sister gave us 500 to give you. It was so heartbreaking. Like I cried a lot when just thinking about it. I will not return the money, but just thinking about it, it used to like kill me. And then in 2013, I brought all of them. We started living together in one house until today.
Wow. And then your daughter, and then you also got remarried, right?
Yeah, so I got my daughter is here. We live here, and I have a fiance now. So everything is just, we hope everything keeps going the way they're going.
Once everybody comes home, does the hustle feel different then? It's like, okay, do you feel in a sense like, okay, I got it. Like they're here. I did it. Or is it like, oh no, they're here. Now I got to really hustle.
Now for me, that was like the first success and probably the only success that I still remember until today. They used to hear stuff. My sister told me they had, I joined a gang and I robbed people and stuff. So even them, when they met me with like, who is this guy? Because we've had a lot of bad things. So the first like month of them like coming back together, it was just talking about our parents, you know, and just telling them like, you know, still we haven't like reached where we like where I really want, but now this is how it's gonna be. You know, if we sleep hungry, all of us, if we eat, all of us, but we're gonna do it here. At least I know my sister's sleeping there, everybody's safe, and I'm gonna protect you guys, and nobody's touching my family now. And for me, that was like the best moment of my life in like since I was 15. That was the first time I was like ever, I think the first time I was like happier was like when my daughter was born, but then it went away so fast because now responsibility was too much. But then the first time I was like genuinely happy and felt like somebody in the world is when my family came.
Is there a specific night or a, I don't know, like a dinner or a meal or like an activity where you just kind of like the world kind of stopped and you thought, wait, they're all here? Or was it just kind of just a big happy blur?
No, it was just, it was like not even real, you know, like they came and it's like you're introducing each other again and you're trying to catch up with what everybody's doing and how they think. You're trying to read their personalities. And it was weird. It was very weird. But inside you just feel this flame. You just feel like, hey man, this like it happened, you know. It's like you've been running a marathon and you're just on the finish line. As much as you're happy you've gotten the gold medal, but you're tired as fuck. You feel like you're gonna die. Yet somebody's like, here's your gold medal, congratulations. And you've been running like 100 kilometers. For them just to give you a gold medal, but it's what you wanted. So it was like mixed feelings. It was just like, man, they're here. So now what next?
Yeah. So how do you go from 2014 and the commercial success locally? What is it? Because look, music has been completely segmented and it's different. It's hard as an artist to make money. There's systems in play in the States and in Europe and in Kenya, in a lot of places, frankly, it's different. So what, I mean, how do you get paid?
For Kenyan music, it was mostly now events and like sponsorship. So I got like a deal with Safaricom for a year and that went really well. So like I toured the whole country in a year. Wow. I did a lot of gigs. I keep like releasing songs after songs. And every year I had like a hot, like number one track every year. I think since 2013, there's no year until today that I don't know, like at least one or two number one tracks in the country.
How do you make that leap to start to, I gotta imagine you think I want to get out of Kenya too. Not physically get out of Kenya, but I want my music to start to get traction. So how do you move through that?
Like now it's like more about networking and people you meet.
Yeah. So that's, and how has it changed in the last 2 years? Because it's kind of keeps, it feels like it just keeps escalating for you. Like you just keep climbing that mountain and people just keep following.
Yeah. Like for me, I started realizing, okay, I've had this success in Kenya, but I want it bigger. I want it Africa. So I started going to like Tanzania, Rwanda. Then I started going to Europe, like through like partnership with organization. I did a London tour with like British Council because I went back there after 8 years as a success story of their program. They gave me a funding to do an album tour in London. From there, I worked with the German embassy, which I ended up in Berlin. In Berlin, I met other people who took me to like Hamburg. After that, just like that, I went to Paris and it kept working like that. And now I went to the States. Through that, I mean, like now different producers, like I meet like producer who produced for Drake, who mix for and master his songs. And I'm like, okay, now if I want to compete with people in Jay-Z level, I have to work with this producer. Through this, I can send my songs to Grammys. And so instead, for me, I started thinking, okay, Kenya was a platform, was a foundation. So now what? What can I do bigger? And now it's not about even hit songs. It's not for me. It's not about like, let me do a song so that I can eat. Now I want to do a song that will be there for a while. I want to do a song that shows the journey. I want to do an album that when people listen 20 years from now, they'll be like, whoa, this guy was ahead of his time. He was like super ahead.
Do you ever think about how, you know, your dad was so influential and playing tracks for you? Do you think about guys like him with kids that would have been your age back at home playing your records? Like, can you take that mental leap and kind of see that?
Yeah, like I thought about that a lot last year when I went to do the anniversary, because like in all those years, now it's been over 15 years, I never did an anniversary because it's so expensive and I couldn't afford. So last year when I did both the anniversary and like cemented the graves and wrote their names and stuff. And that night I was just thinking about it, like if my dad was to be there today, which of my songs will he really understand? Because I'm from a different generation and I rap in like a slang that he doesn't even know what that slang means. But what will he really, according to what he used to listen to Michael Jackson and a lot of Congolese music, a lot of Congolese music. Will he like be proud of these songs, or will he just be proud that I'm an artist and I'm successful, or will he just be like, man, you do whatever you can do to eat? So my album that is yet to be out, I did a whole jazz album as a dedication to my dad, which is really like for me is the best piece of art I've ever put together. So I can't wait to share it with the world. And it was mastered fully with the person who masters like Drake's album is called Chris Athens. It's like the best mastering guy in the world for me, just reaching that level. And I said, this one I'm gonna, and it's very musical. It's not, I was not targeting to do like hit songs. I was just, I wanted to be musical, and every song has a story. The number three or two song is about my mom and my dad's song, and it's called Jazzy. It's a duo like for people that kind of edgy music that has longevity, like 10 years from now, you could listen to it and be relevant. Like my kids, if I was never there and my grandchildren would listen to that, they will know their great-granddad, and they will know me, and they'll know my kids, and they'll know my history. Like, I don't have to be here for the next 100 years. Like, if they have this in archives, they can learn from that. And I can't wait to share that. So I did two albums. There's that, and there's an album that is super commercial. Only radio lit songs. And those I did too. So I can't wait to share this. And these are the ones that I've been releasing like singles slowly by slowly.
Can you give me a couple bars of something that you're like really proud of?
I can, because then I'll spoil the surprise. I'll just say people will wait. I think the first song from the album is New Africa. Education is the key, na mamo de wali goma. That one was the first song I recorded for that album. And it was like how, for me, New Africa is like my mom's vision. You know, like how she used to say, like, hey, you people, you know, look at us and they see problems. So don't always make people see problems, because then that's a weakness. They will take advantage of that. And that's why people like the extra or the Western world will come to Africa and say, you guys are poor. We are going to help you. But in the middle of helping us, they're also robbing us. So it's like there's no after my mom gangster. Now there's the Wild West gangster, where they rob you with like, they'll be with like candies, you know, hey, eat this candy, or like take this medicine and go to bed as we think about how we're gonna dig this hole and get some minerals. And New Africa was that. It was like my mom telling, like, in the next years, this is how the world gonna be. The world is technology, the world is this. So the world is not run by governments right now. Everywhere, whether it's in Africa or another world, is run by corporations. And for me, that's what New Africa was about, because I travel, and when you say, tell people, oh, like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Kenya. Ah, you're from Kenya. So you guys are the Ranas and the Masai Maras. I'm like, no, I'm a rapper. I'm like Jay-Z from there. And I know we have like people who are like computer literate there. We have the best mobile money application in the world where I come from. People don't know that still. People just want to minimize us to, hey, you are from Africa, how many lions do you have?
You're like, we have 400 because they've all been poached.
Yeah, I was like, all of them are in your zoos, we don't have any, you know. So but for me, that was like a wake-up call. And I remember my mom telling me, like, the negatives are in everywhere in the world. She always said, take those two or one positive thing, build on that, make it flammable, that even the negative people start like out thinking it.
It's a wonderful way to walk through the world. And the more money that you get, the more isolated that we get.
We get, yeah. It's like you always have fear of the unknown. Like, even the people you used to be close to, you see them as like a threat, or they're always wanting something. And I never understood it. And through that is when I started working with refugees now, because then I realized, if I feel this way when I'm not in my like country, and like what they tell us from where we come from, what we watch here on TV, that this that side is like milk and honey. But you realize all this stuff is a PR. I went to San Francisco and I've never seen that many homeless people anywhere in the world, not even in any African country I've ever been to. But they never show you that on TV. They show you New York and Hollywood. And yet, when it comes to us, they can never also show like the artists, the best footballers. They will show you Kibera and the Dying Babies. They'll show you Masai Mara and the animals. And every young kid growing in like Europe or America start thinking like, I want to go to Africa to save people. So you realize you meet people here. Sometimes you meet people and you think you've met like a really smart guy because they're from like Europe or like America, and realize they're such douchebags. Like, I'm here to save the world. Like, which world? You can't save the world, you know? And for me, apart from school and mom, I think traveling has really educated me. And I've also been lucky to date people who are not from my culture. Like, my fiance is American, and we always have this little like cultural, you know, arguments all the time, and how, but her being from there and coming here and us meeting means like we're in line in a lot of stuff, and don't believe in that, like the people always come and just like here to help people, because I think it has brainwashed so much, and that's why places like Kibera are never growing, because they expect that there's another NGO that will be opened and they will give us free medication and maybe sometimes give us food, and the only person who can help you has to come from somewhere else. So when I went to a refugee camp in Uganda, and these refugees were dancing for, like, you know, there's like UN people, we went there with UN, and I saw like a family, a dad, a mom, and his kids were dancing, and I started crying. And I told them, stop dancing, because I know they're not dancing. They're like, it's like they're our little entertainment, because they think now that we are come here, if they don't dance, we won't even give them food or any help. So this person is hungry. He's just from war. There's no bad desperation than a family, entire family, mother, dad, and kids dancing for random white dudes. Just because they think, like, if they dance, at least we're going to leave some food. It, like, broke my heart. It, like, took me back. It's like, I was like, so this is me, dad, and mom, and we are dancing for some guys so that they can give us $30. But sometimes it's not dancing. That's how they're, like, crying, or that's, like, they're doing that because that's only the thing they have at that point.
Do you know how many people don't realize, like, how big of a deal that statement is? It's rushing over me right now too, because I clearly know, but to think that dancing is crying,
yeah, you know, like,
it's like a whole kind of purview.
You know, there's that dancing when you go in a club and you're dancing because you're drunk and happy. Then you go to a refugee camp and they're not smiling, and you're there like trying to join and dance. And you're just like, man, something is so wrong.
So the Refugenius feels like your ability to go back to these places, to go back to camps, to go back to your village and say, don't dance for me, because those look like tears.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm here to dance for you. I want you to see that I don't see you as a refugee. I see you as a Refugenius. You're mm-hmm. reframing the entire concept of how they see themselves, and then in turn, how we see them.
It's like ownership of what something people looked at you and felt like you're not. You're just, you will just be like this. And then you take it and own it up. It's like, okay, I'm this guy, but what can I do? What experiences do I have that the other person has not gone through? Those stuff has to make you strong, not to make you weak. And that's what people don't understand. Like, even when you're in the slums, people always like, but I'm just in the ghetto and I'm poor. No, that should be a challenge. Being from the ghetto, being from the slum is that, okay, I've undergone this stuff. So what else I can do more if I put my mind in like that? I really want to get out of here. If I can go through 1, 2, 3, 4, if I've gone through these different countries, if I've been like, I've seen people dying and I'm still surviving, that means I have a purpose. I'm a chosen one. I have to do something. I have to use where I am with the little I have to make people that are like me know that this is not a punishment. This is a challenge, and we have to stand out and say, this is us. So if we're going to sing our songs, we're going to dance to them ourselves.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. You don't know what I go through, bro. Hey.
It's when I see your art, when I talk to you, when I get to hear your stories, it's what breathes new life into a day. It's like what makes me feel alive. So thank you for this.
Thank you too. Yeah, this is like one of the most also personal interviews I've done in a long time.
Hey, Tom.